It's season two of your favorite librarian, the podcast. Let's get started, friends. And this is episode one, Sisterhood with Your Mother's Inner Child. Firstly, I just want to thank you all for joining me. It's been a long time coming. I mean, season two has been delayed, but not denied. And so let me go ahead and pair this week's episode with two brilliant titles by two brilliant Black women. The first is Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen, The Emotional Lives of Black Women by Dr. Inger Burnett Zingler. And the second is First Bloom, Stories of Blossoming Black Lesbian Love by S. E. Howard. And these two titles, I wholeheartedly believe, will guide you along not only some of this week's talking points throughout the episode, but will also guide you to some of the same resolutions and some awakenings that I have had. So I highly encourage you to definitely check out the writings of each author, but specifically the titles for this week's episode. So let's get started with episode one, Sisterhood with Your Mother's Inner Child. There are some specific talking points that I definitely want to highlight that you may want to jot down yourself. The first is defining and ignoring the inner child. The second, we're going to explore not trusting ourselves. The third is projecting and not protecting. And lastly, beating the oppressor, not beating them by becoming them. So let's get started. Number one, and this may be the bulk of our podcast too, defining and ignoring the inner child. You know, beautifully on page 56, Dr. Burnett Zingler defines intergenerational trauma. But something that she also explores is how we recognize unhealthy patterns of behavior that have been passed down to us that we might pass down to our children, or maybe impacting our lives unbeknownst to a level of awareness. And throughout my journey of healing, especially from specific traumas in my childhood, I've had to release the idea of the adults that have been in my life that I believed and wanted to protect me, but have also had to befriend my inner child, but also as the adult, the present adult, and as the adult in consciousness, I in some ways want to befriend my mother's inner child. You know, I come from a Southern Black, very Christian, religion-centered church and family background. And so faith and God and Christianity is at the core of not only identity, community, but just our community. And so there wasn't a space for complexity or otherness or queerness. And so for me, a queer Black girl, it was sometimes restricting. You know what? Not even sometimes. It was on a conscious and subconscious level, it felt like having to find the safest lily pad to jump on because I wasn't clear of the waters I was in. That's the best analogy I can use. And it was because of certain elements of competition, of projection, of unhealed trauma, of a lack of guidance into womanhood through my adolescence and stage of young adulthood that I truly desired. Yet there were elements of nourishment and empathy and compassion. But through a maternal sense, I lacked certain maternal love that I sought through my mother. And I do believe that if I did not acknowledge this early on with the help of great women, mental health professionals, and great women educators, I would have possibly created or passed down an intergenerational trauma. And, you know, Bryant Zingler beautifully defines intergenerational trauma on page 56 as: breaking the cycle specifically of intergenerational trauma is to acknowledge the traumas that exist in our families, the hurt that has grown from them, and the damage that they have caused in us. For some people, a part of addressing family trauma may include confronting people who have caused you harm, perhaps unknowingly, and letting them know how their behavior, have made us feel. Know that your feelings are valid whether they or the other person acknowledges them. This should only be considered in situations where you feel physically, emotionally safe. Otherwise, you may risk being re-traumatized. And, you know, that's true, because in order to grow and learn, you must invite the elders and to encourage us in open conversations when we're trying to specifically heal family issues, but to allow forgiveness to free ourselves from certain anger and certain elements of betrayal that have manifested or transitioned into specific attachments, unbeknownst or consciously to our awareness. And so when she beautifully defines trauma and also distinguishes hurt from pain, but also how these elements and also specific environments can become triggers if you are not aware of yourself, your environment, but also of what may re-traumatize you, but also in certain things that you must prioritize, i.e. forgiveness, a space of openness, but also a willingness to share your story and also to hear others as well. So when I speak about wanting to befriend my mother's inner child, oh man, I look at my mother's relationship to her mother and it is just so beautiful. You know, if there's one word that I could use to describe it, I would say unconditional love. The way my mom describes her relationship with her mother, she saw and heard her regardless of the mistakes or her choosing the wrong men or prioritizing men over her children or over her body or sanity or her education. My grandmother still chose to love her daughter and see her daughter as a full human being without flaw. And I think that in itself is just an act of unconditional love, especially not only because it's your child, but even if it weren't, it's a choice. And that's something that my grandmother practiced and also with me. But something that I seek with my mother is for her to practice that with me. But something that my grandmother had mentioned intimately and individually with me is that my mother doesn't have it to give. And that's something that she would say to me over and over. Your mother doesn't have it to give. Your mother doesn't have it to give. And I would think that, you know, she would be so cruel, but she just didn't understand. And as I would repeat this same phrase and sentiment, it just began to dissolve my walls of confusion to allow me to see through this veil of denial that I had built. And as I continued to say it during times where I felt a void, where I sought comfort or care or support or just simply be uplifted, especially by a feminine maternal energy, something similar to a mother-like love, I thought, oh, wow, I can't imagine, you know, I've always seen my mother in her adult-like state, but I wonder how that child-like state is. I wonder, could my mother love me more in that child-like state instead of as she has always met me in her adult form, if that makes sense. Ooh. We getting deep tonight. Excuse me. So, but let me just also say this. To separate the process of communicating your feelings from the outcome, as also Dr. Brené Ziegler mentions, the person may not be ready to accept their role in the trauma, and in turn may not respond how you'd like. And she mentions, then forgive them. You know, accountability is not blame, and blame is not accountability. When I take accountability of something I've done, or a lack of awareness or action or fortitude or a lack of integrity, I'm not blaming anyone. I'm taking accountability where there was a space I could have occupied or where I did, but where I could have refined my approach. And you're not blaming anyone. I think when you blame someone is a projection, because it doesn't allow you to first speak on self. And not that you have to always speak on self, especially in specific subjective, especially specific, you know, sexual situations. But for this, I don't believe you have to blame someone. It's liberating, and it liberates ourselves when we take accountability. But it's hard when others don't. It's just hardening. It's disappointing. And especially when it's those that we love, especially when we find and see ourselves evolving and changing, it's a blow to the ego. It's a blow to the heart, but it also reminds us of our loss of innocence, as you'll see in chapter 4 with this beautiful book, Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen, the Emotional Lives of Black Women. And, you know, this book truly supported me through understanding not only my relationship with my inner child, healing, befriending, growing my trust with my inner child, but what my relationship could look like in an imaginary world, hypothetically, with my mother's inner child, and how her relationship looks like with her inner child. So, you know, that brings me to defining, and which is a continuation of something we spoke about in season 1 of Favorite Librarian, the podcast. Your inner child is the impression and the impact of some of the greatest memories and your youth that is compressed and compact into you, into your inner being, that will never grow up, however, can be healed and can be loved and can be seen and heard. That is my soul and individual way to define it. Yet when we ignore our inner child, or even the inner child in the adults who are the people who have always been adults in our lives, i.e. our parents, our parental or guardian figures in our life, academic or educational professionals, teachers, professors, principals, mentors, these people have always been adults in our lives. And so there's a level of seeing them in a way where you not idolize or put them on a pedestal, but in a way where you see a certain bond or connection, a pipeline, in a sense where you can grow a bond that is unbreakable, immeasurable. But yet, when we have unhealed trauma, unacknowledged hurt, when we have triggers and intergenerational traumas that are maintained subconsciously or are irrefutably overlooked. I'm not gonna lie, especially for myself, I began and often catch myself not trusting myself. And that leads me into our second point, not trusting ourselves. You know, I grew up in a two-parent household, objectively. But when you look at it, one of my parents is a functional alcoholic and the other is And, you know, I love my parents. I think through their personal journey, through the way they love, the way they receive love, the way they give love, the way they've healed themselves, the way they have rehabilitated themselves, I think is just monumental. It's an act of loving yourself at its highest degree, and it's taught me so much, not only about the world around me, my family, but myself, and how to bloom at any age and stage of your life. But throughout my childhood, I saw my dad, but he wasn't emotionally available. And my mother was not emotionally available as well. You know, I believe that my mother's motherhood was from optical and objective elements that you can almost in a form check off in a list format or approach. And like I said, you know, optically and objectively, I came from a two-parent household. Many people would think, oh, wow, you know, you have a mom and you have a dad. But I don't think people, if they looked a little close, they would see, oh, it's not how it really looks. And, you know, not having both parents that were emotionally available, I do believe really exposed me to a lot of, not situations, but to emotions that I navigated in ways that I possibly shouldn't have in my youth, which exposed me to mature in certain fashions that I would not permit for my own child if I were to have children. Or were to be a guardian of someone, because I had to develop a level of not only trust for myself and awareness, but my maturity I began to weaponize, I believe, because it was all I had in a reflection of credibility. You know, in my youth, especially when there are elements and instances of trauma, especially physically and sexually, the statistics of how many children are abused before the age of 12, especially in Black and brown homes, but also the range of child sexual abuse and violence, not only in siblings and children, extended families, but in the aggressor and their relation to the child. You know, one thing that Dr. Barnett Ziegler beautifully discusses on page 58 is the specific statistics and how disheartening they are because it hits home. Let me just read a few. And how many children have somewhat their youth shortened by some of the physical and sexual abuse, harm, and violence they endure, but their lack of being seen and heard when trying to verbalize some of this impact of abuse. And yet that, and what we mentioned with not trusting ourselves, is how maturity is often weaponized, especially in predators or adults that hypersexualize children. Let me share this with you. It goes, less than 38% of children victims disclose that they have been sexually abused, even if they are explicitly questioned. For children who do not disclose their abuse or do not have a nurturing support system, distorted thoughts about themselves and the accompanying negative emotions can become deeply embedded in their identity. A believing and supporting caregiver can be a strong determinant for a good prognosis following abuse. This is literally the direct words of a well black mental health professional. And so she just simply speaks on how the confidence of a child is affected not only by the environment, but the support system around a child. And, you know, I want to specifically examine female presenting queer folk because, you know, that's the intersection that I'm at. Let me get a sip of this bourbon. Ooh, Lord. We keep this podcast real around here. Always adult friendly and must be over 21 of age. But, you know, children, I believe, are one of the most, I read somewhere and I can't remember. It says children are one of the most oppressed groups in the world because they're never believed, but often overlooked and snubbed, if I'm paraphrasing that quote correctly. And I believe that because their experience is so often considered wrong or misguided or highly fanciful or chimerical, but yet it's highly referenced in their adulthood because it was overlooked in their childhood. And so one thing that she also mentions later on is that victims have difficulty externalizing the abuse and in turn internalize it and think negatively about themselves. Consequently, admitting abuse would come with feelings of shame, self-blame, and guilt, since they believe that they must have caused it to happen. And, you know, those are three things that we're going to talk about throughout this conversation. Shame, self-blame, and guilt. You know, when we talk about shame, it's often a weapon, a tool in the Black community. It's a teaching tool. It allows you to convict someone based upon knowing a lot or a little information about their situation or even the individual. It allows you to convict someone, to persuade them to self-blame, to blame themselves. And this guilt creates this prison that they live in until they can't atone themselves in some imaginary way through this imaginary world that you've created through this ungodly behavior and decision. And again, it allows the person, not victim, because people are not victims unless you consider yourself to be. And if you use that term, I embrace it. But when people are at risk of not healing in ways that can properly uplift themselves, they begin to not trust themselves. And I think that's why my mother and I aren't able to truly bond in ways that I wish. And so when I want to retreat or gain a love that feels like a hug, or that feels like, okay, I feel seen and heard. I feel like that when I read First Bloom. The stories in this book are just, oh man, they're just so juicy and good. Now, some of them can be a lie, I'm not gonna lie, but I love them. Like Almost First Kiss by Eternity P, Just Friends, which is by Cat Williams. And another one which I do love is Turpentine and Cigarettes. And that one is by Fiona Z. Z-E-D-D-E. Brilliant black queer woman who also used to work for Karis Books and More, which is in Atlanta. Brilliant title. But I read First Bloom when I need to just take a break from some of this heavy thought, especially when I am trying to navigate some of the vulnerability of my childhood, where most of my impact is, or of certain maltreatment lies. And so that leads me to our third point, projecting is not protecting. You know, I believe projection is an extension of blaming. When you're projecting, you're pointing. You're in a sense redirecting the attention of not only the room, but entirely you're redirecting the entire attention, of the equation, the attention, the arena onto one person or individual. So projecting, in my experience, and in my humble and honest opinion, is a form of, you know, projecting is a form of, whatchamacallit. But I don't think you're protecting yourself. It's almost in a form a defense mechanism. Defense mechanisms do not protect you. They get you through a situation or through the day. And one thing I find between black mother and daughter relationships is how dismissals are a teaching tool, are a way to lessen someone's joy or accomplishment. Dismissing joys, pleasures, and growth in black girls is a common thing in mothers who have a great deal of unhealed trauma or negative impact from their youth. For example, with my mother, I'll never forget when I called her during the process when I applied for a position to be on the board of directors for Atlanta Pride. I just simply applied and I got a response, and I called my mom. Oh my goodness, I called my mom. I called my mother so excited. And she was like, oh, okay. And don't forget, you need to make sure that you save during these times. And I was like, hold on, do you hear that I just got a response? She's like, okay, I said, good job. And XYZ. And I was like, Mom, do you know how hard I worked for that? And she was like, okay. And continued talking about the next subject. And I felt so dismissed. And then I just simply stopped her and I said, hey, let me stop you right here. Because I feel simply dismissed by how quickly you jump to another subject. And it makes me feel snubbed and overlooked. And although you may want to discuss something else, right now I would like my joy and accomplishment to be centered, as I don't feel like I am centered in a lot of spaces where I share very sacred information with you. Baby, when I told my mama that, it was like I told her a cheesy joke and she kept it pushing. It was like I told her the weather forecast for yesterday. All she did was blink and kept it moving. I felt so frustrated because although, and like I mentioned before, she didn't have it to give. And yes, I gave her an opportunity to try. It's not my task or responsibility to give her an opportunity or to make opportunities. It's my responsibility to give myself the space to grow, to learn. And when I meet her at certain spaces, environments, and bridges, if I feel the space and it is not draining of my energy to do so, then I will create an opportunity at that time for her, but not consistently. And when I say not consistently, that's because I want to protect my peace and my inner child. You know, my main priority is myself. I have to live my life for me. For so many years, for so long, I consciously, subconsciously, and in an act to reinvent myself from this version people were attached and committed to believing I was, that I tried to combat with. But I learned quickly, I have to live my life for myself. And this allowed me to free myself. You know, there's this beautiful quote from Toni Morrison from Beloved, where she says, freeing yourself was one thing. Claiming ownership of that freed self was another. And I believe that because in order to have a healthy relationship with anyone, mutual respect, empathy, boundaries, safe for individuality, open communication, support, these things and a list of others are needed. You know, a solid, healthy relationship is one where you feel safe to be vulnerable and show up as your complete, authentic self. And resistance to vulnerability has kept many Black women from being able to rest and support and comfort with the people that they love and choose to be around them. But what Dr. Barnett Zingler beautifully discusses in chapter 6, entitled I Can Do Bad All By Myself, she explores and defines the cycle of violence. And the first is tension building, and the second is acute violence. And you know, tension building is basically self-explanatory from day to day, or where one person either is feeling ignored or threatened, or there's a level of anger. You're walking on eggshells, basically. You're trying to be complimentary, complacent, but nurturing. But, you know, when she speaks about acute violence, it's typically preceded by verbal abuse or outbursts of violence, or where the victim feels literally powerless. And then in that cycle of violence, you have the reconciliation, where you apologize or love dump, or where the violence is excused or dismissed, or even your emotions are dismissed. It's not that deep, or if this didn't happen, I wouldn't have reacted in such a way. And then before the storm, there's the calm that she mentions, where before the tension building phase begins that starts this cycle, there's this peace, and it's inevitable. It's calm, it's centered, it's centering, It's a fulcrum almost. And I thought, oh my goodness, yes. And I realized I somewhat have this cycle with my mom where there's this tension that's bubbling. And there's this small act or outburst or this peak of tolerance, this cliff almost that we're at. And then there's this blow up or there's this level of violence. And then the reconciliation, the I'm sorry, or maybe not a direct acknowledgement, or but just an overflow of loving, love bombing, which is reconciliation. And that's something that she discusses with prioritizing, you know, your attention to self. And your attention to self is a reflection of your self-care, your self-love, your resilience, but also, you know, your emotional impact can be life-threatening or almost as severe as a life-threatening injury. And for many Black women, with inadequate protection throughout your childhood, this kind of violence can impact you throughout your life. If it is unacknowledged, if it is not addressed, but also if you don't gain a level of awareness to see how this treats you. You know, one level of emotional abuse I endured throughout my childhood was the silent treatment, which she speaks about. Dr. Barnett Zingler, you know, she directly defines the silent treatment as a form of emotional abuse when intended to hurt you, take away your control, or silence you when you try to set a boundary. It can be used to shift blame onto you or make you feel guilty, and it ends only on the other person's term. And that's on page 97, her definition of the silent treatment. But she further, you know, discusses it on page 96, where she says the silent treatment is a passive aggressive style of communication that people use when they become overwhelmed, angry, and frustrated, and don't know how to express their emotions. It allows them to avoid conflict by shutting down emotionally, pushing feelings down, and directly confronting issues. People pretend they're fine. They don't care about the situation at hand and or are completely in control of their feelings. When people give someone the silent treatment, they are often trying to punish the other person by making them feel the negative emotion, such as feeling the hurt or rejection that they felt. It can also be used as a manipulation tactic. And when the silence is broken, the issue is swept under the rug and the problem is never addressed. So see, it's that same cycle of violence and, you know, questioning voices of blame, guilt, and self-doubt. They can overtake you and they can almost keep you from being able to think about anything else. It's when you think about, how do I take control of my thoughts and my emotions and my behaviors? And then you remember this inherent self-worthlessness because of a lack of being able to set healthy boundaries to maintain a healthy, solid relationship. From the passive-aggressive style of communication and the lack of true control of certain conversations, especially with the silent treatment, certain emotional abuse has allowed you to maintain a level of confusion, which is self-decapitating, or depreciating. Ooh, excuse me. That's this bourbon. And it can ultimately make you feel powerless. And, you know, again, that's where we had first mentioned with our second portion of not being able to trust ourselves. You know, being or functioning in a cycle or an environment of chaos, abuse, mistreatment, or a lack of self-respect, you're not able to really have a true image of self, establish identity, healthy boundaries, to maintain those healthy boundaries, or to even have proper lines or tools of communication. And when you elevate or become an adult or arrive to your adulthood, it is often overwhelming when we reach conflict or have these bouts of confusion or even just simply ebbs and flow. And one thing beautifully that Dr. Barnett Ziegler mentions is with intergenerational trauma is almost with the act of revenge. Not only can you ignore something physically, but distance is a form and rejection is also a form of projection. It's a form of control. It's an extension of protecting yourself. It rejects the other person from any form in any way having the capacity to have a function outside of where they once occupied, and that's in your past where most of the impact happened, and allowing them a chance to act as a tool, a part of your healing is unrealistic and somewhat surreal because of how we and where we place them and how we are attached to some of our hurt and not our healing. And so when she speaks about healing intergenerational trauma, she talks about specifically Black women's relationship with self, their identity, pain, trauma, community, but their relationship with their mothers. And that's something that I find that is so uplifting, because she doesn't directly say it, but I want to directly mention and speak on it. Sisterhood, you know, in its entirety, this episode, sisterhood with your mother's inner child, is about sisterhood. You know, the element of sisterhood does not consist of competition. It's all about uplifting, guiding, supporting, but most importantly, showing love unconditionally, similar to what my grandmother extended to my mother. Unconditional love was an act of also sisterhood, because it didn't engage any element of competition. But that's not something that I got to experience with my mother. In some way, there is a level of competition through how she dismisses my accomplishments and accolades, through how sometimes she may snub or belittle some of my joys or pleasures in an act of equating it to my youth or my lack of experience, but not simply being happy for me in just my simple small joy. And so what I've learned to do is learn to trust myself, learn to appreciate my joys and happiness, my loves, my comforts, and also to extend grace to myself throughout my healing, to forgive myself for expecting me to know and have it all put together when I was simply doing my best. And through that, I've learned that I cannot beat my oppressor by becoming my oppressor. I can't beat my mother at this game of womanhood or being a better woman than she ever is or was or could ever be by being the better woman. No, I have to be the better me. I can't be this imaginary better woman than she was, because again, that creates a level of competition. And I've already become her by trying to beat who she is. And that's not what it's about. So I've learned that if I can in some way be her sister. So in this imaginary world, I'm not going to lie, if I could have an imaginary friend, it would be my mom's inner child. If I could have a friend, if you could give me a wish and said, Forrest, if you could have one friend in the world, who, imaginary, fiction, real or not, who would they be? I would say, I would want to be friends with my mom's inner child. Simply put. Simply put, that is what I would want to do. That would be my wish. I know that sounds cheesy. Because in chapter 7, Suffering from the Womb, she beautifully speaks about not only PTSD, maternity and healthcare for and in black, for black women, but also intimate partner violence, sexual violence, but also how some women just simply do not know about themselves or the fundamental pillars of womanhood to pass that on to someone. And so it leaves them exposed to a level of violence that they may endure or harm or lack of care, especially when parenting. And you know, the quote that she mentions from I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou, I think that quote just beautifully sums up the intersection, the complexities, the intelligence, but also the unseen world of black women and motherhood, but also how that looks for different women. And, you know, when she further discusses also, not only solely about the maternal side of parenting, but the daddy, the father presenting side with chapter 9, daddy issues, there are a lot of ways your childhood and youth without a balanced system of support, not just from a two-parent household, but from having a balanced support of energies that best reflect the child's growth and spirit and essence. The child may mature into a person without all the elements to be emotionally sound, safe, and balanced. You know, on page 128 at the top, she mentioned psychologically, children are suddenly separated from their parents, can become emotionally numb and detached as a way of protecting themselves from the hurt of a future loss or a disappointment. They seem unbothered and as if they don't care about much of anything. My mother was apathetic when it came to her father. She didn't question his whereabouts or express feelings of longing for him. As a child, she saw him during occasional trips back to Montgomery to visit her family. She felt odd because she felt no connection to him and didn't know what to say to him. He was just somebody they told me was my father, she said. You know, I used to feel like that about my dad growing up because I saw him every day. We went through the motions, dinner, lunch, but I didn't know anything about him. He didn't know much about me. He wasn't present much in my life. The lights were paid. Water was running. Hot water was there. Food in the fridge. Clothes in the closet. But other than that, I didn't know him. So I just called him Dad. That was my thinking as a child. And it almost rings not identical, but similar to Dr. Bornet Zingler's words of her mother. And so I too had some of those similar feelings of not expressing a longing for him, but I was almost apathetic to him growing up, numb because of how separated I was. You know, children can feel a range of emotions in response to a separation or a divorce, high levels of parental conflict during or after separation, with poor attachment to the child. But you can see a decline in a child's behavior, not only through separation anxiety, but through how they demonstrate preference or their sleeping patterns or new interests or how they form their identity or evolve. You know, children are born to indefinitely grow, but have difficulty developing their own intimate relationships with self and developing their own identity. I mean, simply put, it's the vulnerability that children have that they share effortlessly at youth. But with the loss of innocence, they hide that vulnerability as they mature into adulthood, as they see how it is often weaponized. So let me go ahead and wrap up this episode, because I know we're getting a little long-winded. I usually try to keep these under 45 minutes, but I think we're going over to about an hour now. On page 160... there are some great resources and great titles by other Black psychiatrists, therapists, and mental health professionals. Therapy for Black Girls, founded by clinical psychologist Dr. Joy Harden Bradford. Girl Trek, founded by Morgan Dixon and Vanessa Garson. The Homecoming Podcast by clinical psychologist, ordained minister, and sacred artist, Dr. Thelma Bryant Davis, and, you know, just a few others. The Black Mental Wellness, also founded by a clinical psychologist, Dr. Nicole Klamick, Danielle Bussey, Dana Cunningham, and Jessica Henry. Sorry, I had to remember all of their names. But one thing I also just want to share with you guys with this week's episode is some of the suggestions that Dr. Bornet Zingler mentioned in chapter 15. Self-care is not selfish. You know, based on her grandmother's guidance, but also through some of her own professional insight, she provided some suggestions to just help uplift and to uplift the Black woman, but to improve your mood and well-being and your daily life. And those are: maintain a routine, get dressed, do the things that bring you joy, eat mindfully, create a space, set manageable goals and expectations, pay attention to your thoughts, practice self-compassion, look through the wide lens, have clear and manageable goals, set expectations, reach out to your support system, exercise, and most importantly, don't forget to breathe. Now, she goes in depth about how all of these look on page 220. And if you want a continuation of that, you can check out chapter 16, Joy Comes in the Morning, where she also continues and shares some of her religious faith. But you'll also notice some of her great talking tips towards the back. But one thing that I really enjoyed about this title is how it explores specific impacts that influence hurt or projections or even the unbalance in many Black women's lives, and how to provide a fulcrum to where you now can walk with balance, grace, and centered with your peace. And even through a loss of innocence, you can have sisterhood with your inner child. You can have sisterhood with the inner children of the women around you and the women with you in your corner. But also that you can experience a freedom when you take ownership of your freed self and when you free yourself. But for myself individually, after an act of freeing myself and others, one wish I have is to seek sisterhood with my mother's inner child. And although I know that sounds unrealistic and highly fanciful, very unrealistic to some. They're like, Forrest, are you serious? But to myself, yes. That's how I wanted to start season 2 of Favorite Librarian, the podcast, out. I hope you enjoyed it. And stay tuned for episode 2. And until then, I'll see you next time, friends.
Remember, friends, there is something out there for you. And for more Black and queer literature, be sure to check out favoritelibrarian.com or my Instagram, favoritelibrarian.